the denomination that I grew up in, into the Episcopal Church, and the denomination I was originally ordained in, was that we got to live in the Washington, D.C. area, and there are downsides of that, too, but there are big upsides, and one of the big upsides for our family was that we lived about, like a 10-minute drive from Mount Vernon, which is the estate of George Washington, and you could buy a season pass, which we bought when we got down there, and you could go down and see George Washington Estate anytime we wanted, and it's a living farm, so they try to grow things on that farm the way they did when George Washington was there running the estate, and they had animals there the way that George Washington did when they were running the estate. And one of our kids, which I won't say, was still small enough that they were entranced when the sheep started being born about February at this estate. And so we would make special trips down to go and see these sheep that were growing up to, have wool on them that could be sheared and turned into garments later. So when we got back, we knew how good this experience with the sheep was. We started to do some investigation. Is there a way we could foster this interest and try to find a place where we could continue to go visit sheep every spring? And we were striking out a little bit, and then we happened to go, of all places, to a Christmas tree farm in December of that year. And part of this other operation on this Christmas tree farm was that they had sheep there. So I asked the fella, can we come visit your sheep? And he said, well, our sheep won't be around very long. And the reason is, there's a different kind of shepherd than the ones that grew this wool on it, the shear, and turned it into flock. This guy was growing sheep to turn it into meat. And as a realization to me, there is more than one kind of shepherd in this world. Some people raise sheep to make sweaters out of their wool, and some people raise sheep so that you can have a big Easter dinner. So, you don't want to get them confused. And so, the reason I tell you that story is because the shepherd that we have is a different kind of shepherd than we sometimes think. And this psalm that we love so much, not to, completely break it down and deconstruct all of your warm, fuzzy feelings about it, the shepherd in the psalm may not be exactly the shepherd that you expected to find. In fact, the language of shepherd that's being used in the psalm is more akin to the cultural cousins of the ancient Hebrews, the Mesopotamians, than it is to the shepherds that we think about who sit out all day in the field with their sheep and just, enjoy the sunset each night. Shepherd is the language of a person being a king. In fact, a person being a king who protects their flock, their people. In fact, we have all over the ancient world these pictures of shepherd kings, and what they are doing is they are putting down the predators to their flock. We have this picture of this, Akkadian king from Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, and he is standing there in a line, and he's being dispatched by this king. And the title is Shepherd King. The shepherd that is in view here is a shepherd who protects their flock at all costs, and actually, in many cases, has the supernatural abilities to protect the flock against all kinds of peril. Which is why, when we meet David and hear about him for the first time in the Old Testament, we hear of his exploits first. He's able to kill a bear and a lion to protect his flock. And then, in his very first story, he protects the people of Israel from this supernatural villain and threat and Goliath. That's the kind of shepherd here. The shepherd in view here is the shepherd who protects and has the ability to protect at all costs. So what happens here is we have a thesis statement in the very first thing of the psalm. The Lord is my shepherd. Equal sign, I shall not be in want, is what we have. Or really two little words that just mean I never lack. I have no lack. Everything is sufficient that the shepherd is. And so that thesis statement is what guides the images of the rest of the psalm. And so we walk our way through those. They are the challenge to that thesis. The thesis that I will not lack if the Lord is my shepherd is presented to us first in an being in a place of satisfaction. A place that was the place that you want to be, where you're full and you're fed and there's water. And it's easy for the shepherd to protect you from the threats around. In fact, the next line is, in the green fields, he makes me lie down. Beside still waters, I'm refreshed, I drink, and he leads me there. And so the image of the shepherd as protector starts in a place where it's easy to protect. But it moves, even in that line, from a place of being still to a place of movement. The first line is, he makes me lie down, I'm still. The second line is, he makes me get up and walk. The image of the pasture is not one that hangs around for a long time. Our shepherd is not the kind of shepherd that lets us stay in a pasture. Our shepherd is not the kind of shepherd that can only protect us in this place. So the shepherd puts us on the road. And so the second image is of traveling. He revives my soul and he guides me along the right pathways for his name's sake. We have left the meadow and we're moving on, and even the easiest road will make us become out of breath. And this shepherd is so good that this line, he revives my soul, is very literally says, my breath he returns. That when you get out of breath on this road that the shepherd will take you on, you find it again. You have worked so hard that you cannot breathe. You know what it's like to huff and puff. But now the shepherd can restore it, can give you the energy, the endurance to go on this journey with the shepherd. And this road, though it is more dangerous than the meadow that you were just in, it's not quite as dangerous as about the place where you're about to go. Because the place where you're about to go does not have the shepherd's name on it. Because this next line is really, he takes you on the roads that have his name. So these are still shepherd's roads. You've left the meadow where it is peaceful, it's time to go. You are getting worn out, but you are refreshed. But you are still in a place where there is some control for just a little while longer. Now, I told you one of the nice things about living in Washington, D.C. was when we got to go to Mount Vernon. One of the things that was a little difficult from time to time was, and this is the early days of GPS, you would have to get somewhere across town. And those early GPSs did not care the route that you went as long as it was the shortest one. And I remember one time driving to Washington, D.C., which has some very nice parts. It also has some parts where I was a little frightened. And in fact, it was at one time in particular, I remember being in such an inhospitable part of town that I was really praying for no car trouble. And so we're passing through. It has nothing to do with urban. I've actually been in some northern Wisconsin towns where I say the same prayer. So that is the kind of feeling of the next image. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, or the shadow, or the deepest, darkest valley you can enter, I will fear no evil. I'll fear no bad thing. And you can imagine, you've probably done this too, where you've been in a big city, or you've been in a place where you're not really comfortable, and you drive through, and you feel like there is peril in this place. And in the ancient world, there are no GPSs, and it has little to do with the fact there are no satellites, though that's a big part. It has to do with the fact there are very few roads, because it's very hard to travel. And so sometimes these roads have to go places where you cannot see what is coming. And the idea here in this image is that you walk into a place where you have no sight. This is the darkest valley you can imagine. This is a place where it is so deep and the walls on the cliffs are so high, you cannot see what's coming next. And yet in this place where there is no sight, I know that I am safe because the Lord is my shepherd. I'm satisfied. I have no lack. Now, folks that read this psalm as thinking that this is all about sheep get into a big problem with the next image that challenges this idea of the shepherd. And that is this image that I prepares the table in the presence of my enemies. He anoints my head with oil. My cup runs over. That is a very funny image if you've been imagining sheep this whole time. Because sheep eating in front of a table full of people, being anointed with oil, having too much wine to drink, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But the truth is, that makes more sense than what I think is implied by this image. Because if you've been thinking about the shepherd as the king, as the one who is leading his people, leading really an army, taking them from their safety in their homes, across a road that he owns, through a valley that's so dark, into a foreign land to meet an enemy. You know what happens in most stories when you meet that enemy? You engage in violence and in battle. But not with the shepherd. The shepherd who has taken you on a journey from lying beside still waters and sitting in the warm grass with the sunshine on you has taken you to meet the enemy. You know what happens when you meet the enemy? You have a banquet. This is the irony. This is the surprise. This is the flip of the psalm. This is the point where the ancient reader would go, that's not the way this goes. I know shepherds. They're generals. They take their armies. They go on trips. And when they get there, there is carnage. There are not banquets. Not for the people that I hate. Not this shepherd. The shepherd is not that kind of shepherd, even if the imagery starts in that place. The kind of shepherd who takes you to a place of peace with your enemies, so much so that you'll sit down in a lavish and abundant banquet and party with one another. And then the final image of this psalm. Still very military, though we miss it. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life. The word here for follow is never used with goodness and mercy. You know what the word here for follow is normally used with? It's normally used with an opposing army. In fact, this word normally is translated pursue. And in all other Old Testament stories where we see this word, that surely goodness and mercy are following me, it is normally there is an army who is pursuing me. Or the ancient Israelites are pursuing the people they just vanquished in a battle to completely wipe them out. This is not the picture of like two fairies, goodness and mercy, kind of floating behind you on your daily walk in life. This is the idea that the army that is chasing you down on the after you met the enemy, that's goodness and mercy. They are going to pursue you. They are going to track you down, and they are going to overcome you. It's not just a nice image of the way that you feel. This is the direct and ambitious and aggressive and vigorous way that goodness and mercy seek you to overcome you. Because the place you are left is in the place, the house of the Lord. It is another one of these things where, though you pick up different translations, you'll see that though we in the Protestant world and most of the Christian world have translated this well in the house of the Lord forever, it is in dispute what we are doing in the house of the Lord. Because it's very possible, without changing anything in the text, we should translate it, and I will return to the house of the Lord forever. That this journey that was begun by you being in a place of safety, and you're a shepherd saying, I can just protect you here, but I know I've got better protection for you. I can protect you on the road, I can protect you in the valley, I can take you to the table where your enemies are, I can pursue you with goodness and mercy, and I can bring you back home safe. I can bring you back home, and even though we have left this place, we all are accounted for, and we all are back here for the longest days of us into danger but returns us again. So back to that thesis statement at the beginning. There's something else that's so interesting about this. The Lord is my shepherd. I wrote, Adonai wrote me, the Lord is my shepherd. Two words. We get 11 English words out of 4 Hebrew words at this point. They're super packed. But this lo ehesar, the second thing, if you were an ancient Hebrew reader, you would say, you know what that looks like to me? That grammatically and syntactically looks to me just like a commandment. Because if you could see a commandment in Hebrew, they would look identical, grammatically and syntactically. And this has, I think, several important things for us to remember when we think about the time of the shepherd. God is. Because as my Hebrew 1 teacher taught me when you're learning to read the Ten Commandments for the first time, one thing about that syntactical construction is that this is one that is in perpetuity and ongoing always. The negative of the cow, imperfect, the technical term. All that means is this has power in this present moment and iteratively in all moments into the future and forever. There's a way to construct a negative that is just for now. That is not this. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want, not right now, not in this moment in the future, and not at any future moment ever. It goes on. And the other is the commandment to enjoy. To enjoy the fact that if the Lord is your shepherd, there is no lack. And it doesn't mean that you're always on a good road. It doesn't mean you don't get out of breath. It doesn't mean you get in places where you cannot see. It does not mean that you don't encounter your enemies. But every one of those encounters, at this moment now, and every moment in the future, and as far as it can be seen into time, you lack